History turned in the spring of 1865. The Confederacy was beaten on the battlefield, but some rebel commanders prepared to move into the hills and thick forests of the South to conduct a guerrilla war. If Robert E. Lee had raised his sword to anoint that campaign, it could last for years, make the North regret its victory, and embolden rebels in other regions. The United States could be splintered into dozens of contending states like Europe. The history that did and did not happen is the story of a new book by Jay Winnick. April 1865, The Month That Saved America, presents deft and searing portraits of Lincoln, Grant, and Sherman, Lee, Jefferson Davis, and John Wilkes Booth, in a time when personal human quality may have counted for as much as the weight of history. Mr. Winnick, who writes for the Wall Street Journal and teaches at the University of Maryland, joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Scott, it's great to be here.
Would it be fair to say that in the spring of 1865, the Confederacy had a more coherent view of what they were as a nation than the Union did?
You know, that I never actually thought of it quite that way, but I think you're putting your finger on something. If you look at how the Confederacy was talking about itself, they would go into church and they compare themselves to the Jews wandering in a desert. They saw themselves as this kind of beleaguered, isolated people, and somehow Providence was not smiling well upon them, but if only they could hang on a little bit longer. What it shows is by the end, they really had solidified a Confederate national identity, which for all the tensions that were riveting them, somehow they became their own nation. And of course, that raises the question, how did that nation soon become integrated into the larger Union at the end of the war? That was the task for Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. April of 1865, Lee makes a strategic decision to abandon Richmond, the Confederate capital, to fall back and try and reach Confederate forces which are farther south. It's a strategic retreat and an amazing one covering hundreds of miles. I want to get you to read an extraordinary section of that march because there was nothing to replace the human foot here. And for anything you would eat, you would have to carry it along, which firstly, they didn't have the foot. Well, look, I'm just going to get you to read it.
Okay.
It's a wonderful passage.
Okay. As they marched, the Army of Northern Virginia tore branches off trees, fitfully gnawed at wild buds, and even peeled and ate the bark itself. Every sudden halt saw a new round of men, like dim purgatorial souls, pitifully sink to their knees, or senselessly wander off in search of food or the restful escape of a long, deep sleep. Artillery mules collapsed, forgotten, and roads turned liquid by the rain. Wagons slid into muddy ruts and abruptly halted, sunk axle-deep and waterlogged, too heavy for the malnourished horses to pull them. They were summarily abandoned. And weary men discarded their weapons so as to have only themselves to drag along. In every direction, the dead, men, mules, and horses, began to litter the roadside. Dense columns of smoke rose from exploding vehicles, and shells burst after being touched by flames. It was now a race for life or death, one soldier concluded. Indeed it was. Following alongside, Lee learned from two captured federal spies that the Union was gaining ground. He pushed his men that much harder.
What kept him marching? It's like a death march. You read about Bataan or Corregidor.
Yeah. No, it really was like a death march, and yet they were marching because they still believed in their cause, and as much as anything else, they believed in the man who was their commander, Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. Well, that introduces the idea that was a revelation to me about the distinct possibility that the Confederacy could undertake a campaign of guerrilla war.
Yeah.
Now, explain this to us, because we think of guerrilla war as maybe principally an invention of the 20th century, but in fact, it goes back centuries.
Yeah, it goes back centuries, and they were well aware of it. You know, Robert E. Lee's father fought as a partisan against the British. In 1807, Napoleon fought a fierce war against the Spanish, and they were called guerrilleros.
Yeah.
And that's where the term begins. Yeah. And he referred to the guerrillas as his Spanish ulcer. And Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and the men of the Confederacy were all well aware of this. And more than that, one of the questions that they would have to ask, could they have carried out a guerrilla war? Well, let's look at some of the men who would have carried it out for Robert E. Lee, who have been memorialized in song and in history and legend and in Hollywood. Men like John Mosby, the dreaded cavalry rider, or Nathan Bedford Forrest, about whom William Sherman, the great Union general, said, "That man is the devil, and we must capture him and kill him if it costs us 30,000 lives or bankrupts the U.S. Treasury." Well, of course, that never happened, and he was still out waiting to do the bidding. In other words, the South had the riders, they had the fighters, they had the temperament for a guerrilla war. The South itself was a maze and a tangle of swamps and streams and forests. And arguably, if they had decided to wage guerrilla warfare, it would have been one of the most formidable forces in all of history.
A guerrilla war could have lasted for a generation.
Yes, it could last for a generation or perhaps many generations. I mean, in effect, what we're talking about is no less than the Vietnamization of America.
Why did Robert E. Lee decide against that?
He did decide against it, and I think he decided against it because of another factor that he had to weigh, and that was one word, Missouri, because in Missouri there was already a full-scale guerrilla war taking place. And for your listeners to understand just what was it like in its carnage and its scope and pitting neighbor against neighbor with routine hangings and shootings and knifings, it was, as Lincoln said, it was the very visitation of evil. And as Lincoln also said, nothing we do makes it better. And in the final analysis, Lee decided that if they carried out guerrilla warfare, it would not only destroy the North, but the South and the entire country, and it would take many, many generations for the country to recover. And he was quite prescient, obviously, in thinking that. So hope against hope from his point of view, with his heart heavy, it was at that juncture he said, now I must go and meet General Grant and surrender, and I'd rather die 1,000 deaths than do that. But whereas Lee is often remembered as a great military general and a great tactician who bested all the Union generals before that, his finest moment really came not in war but in peace, in saying no to guerrilla warfare and in helping heal the nation.
Mm-hmm. Lee is a very appealing figure in your book.
Yeah.
And I have to say, a revelation to me. I'm from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
We got no statues to him there.
Mm-hmm. There is a reason why he is adulated the way he is in many respects. When he squares off against U.S. Grant, you know, the great Union general, in the Wilderness campaign, in 6 weeks alone, Grant will lose as many men as Lee has in his entire army. He will lose as many men almost as we lost in the entire Vietnam War. That's the kind of imposing figure that Lee was. And just weeks later, at a sleepy little place called Cold Harbor, again, Grant will lose 9,000 men in 9 minutes alone. It is far worse in its carnage and scope than Pickett's charge was at Gettysburg. And that afternoon, someone will raise the possibility of another offensive, and a man will bellow in Grant's presence, I will not charge hell itself if Jesus ordered it. That was the kind of figure that Lee cut militarily. He's worthy of us thinking about as a suitable partner and figure every bit as much as Grant and Sherman and certainly and even Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. And thereby he became Lincoln's partner in peace.
Yes. It's both riveting and it's also very poignant. That morning when Lee says, I now must become General Grant's
prisoner,
yeah, right. And I must go and surrender. What follows is Appomattox. Now, let's look at it not from our perspective with 136 years of hindsight, but look at it how they saw it. How would Lee be treated? Well, we know Lee was nervous. He was speaking in mumbled half sentences. He was actually quite nervous that morning. And history told him he would not be treated well because throughout history, defeated revolutionaries and generals and traitors were beheaded or they were hung. Or they were imprisoned, or like Napoleon, they were exiled. And indeed, that very day, the Chicago Tribune said, hang Lee. And just days before, the Union Vice President Andrew Johnson and a number of senators before a throng of really over 1,000 people went out and gave this kind of blood-curdling speech in which he said, we must hang Davis, we must hang Lee, we must hang them 20 times. So Lee didn't know how he would be treated. And if Lee's finest moment comes in saying no to guerrilla warfare, well, so too this will be U.S. Grant's finest moment in the surrender at Appomattox.
Mm-hmm. U.S. Grant was a warrior. U.S. Grant was a man who, I think it's fair to say, found his life's work in the business of war.
Yeah, he found his voice in war as a warrior. And throughout much of the war, he was both loved on one hand, but he was also decried for his sending men into battle like slabs of meat just to be slaughtered.
Mary Todd Lincoln called him a butcher, didn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she called him a butcher. And in 1864, they were calling for his head. But but Abraham Lincoln said, we need him because he fights. But anyway, that having been said, this warrior, he will come to Appomattox. And all of a sudden, this son of a tanner is receiving the surrender of Robert E. Lee. And it's quite stunning what happens. The first 15 minutes, what they did is they talked about the old days. In fact, Grant says, I remember you from the Mexican War. And Lee says, you know, I've tried to recall your face many times, but I never could quite do it. Mm-hmm. And eventually, at a certain point, Lee says, well, I suppose we should talk about the matter of hand surrender.
And now, in these days, maybe we should remind ourselves, there was no cell phone with Abraham Lincoln on the other end saying, do this, don't do that, sign this, don't sign that.
Yeah.
Grant was on his own.
Grant was on his own. All Grant knew is that Abraham Lincoln wanted there to be no bloody work, no hangings. Despite what some people were saying in the Union, he wanted there to be a tender peace in which the Southerners would become our countrymen again. And Grant really made good on that. He handled it brilliantly with dignity and grace and real shrewdness and insight. One of the first things he does is he allows the defeated Confederates to keep their sidearms. Mm-hmm. Now, this makes no sense if the Confederate president is on the run calling for guerrilla warfare. Yeah. Yet he does this because Grant was saying, as Lincoln hoped he would say, that we may have defeated you, but we will not dishonor you. We may have defeated you, but we still respect you and we want you to be our countrymen again. But the most poignant scene of all happens a few moments later. The surrender is concluded, the letters are exchanged, and Lee will shake hands with everyone in the Wilbur McLean house. And then Lee walks out. He walks down the stairs, one step, another step, another step. The men are watching for miles, dotting the hills. They're watching every moment to see what will happen next. And Lee finally pumps his fist once, he pumps it twice, he pumps it a third time, and he calls out in a choked, hoarse voice, "Orderly, orderly," for his horse. He mounts his horse Traveler, and then he lets out a large, deep sigh. Like this. And everyone just tenses, you know, thousands of people watching. And what happens next is U.S. Grant comes out, and U.S. Grant at that point tips his hat in salute, in recognition to his fallen foe, to Robert E. Lee. And this one scene, this one act, as much as anything else, will convey generosity that will become echoed and reverberate in every corner and every nook and cranny of the South that year and for years to come, setting a tone for the healing to come. And it was really Grant's finest moment.
Let's talk, as we could talk endlessly now, about Lincoln. In the spring of 1865, how was Lincoln seeing events?
At this point in the spring of 1865, Lincoln is exhausted. He is weary. And of course, he's worried about the war, when it will end, how it will end, where it will end. But Lincoln does one other thing, which really has to make him stand out in history, not only for America, but for all the world to think about, which is, he says when the war is over, there must be no bloody work, there must be no hangings. Of course, he's thinking about the French Revolution, mm-hmm. which was close to them in time and space. There, the revolutionaries started out with the noblest of ideas and ideals, but before everyone knew it, they were guillotining the opposition, and then they were guillotining each other, and it started this endless cycle of bloodshed, civil war, more civil strife, and Lincoln didn't want that to happen here. There is a scene that takes place in Richmond after Richmond has fallen. And Richmond burns. It is burned to the ground. Some 20 square blocks are unrecognizable. This was not what Sherman did.
Right.
Lincoln cared very deeply that Richmond be treated with a respect because of its special place in American history. But the Confederates actually set torch to it, and then it got out of hand as they retreated. But into this ghastly visage came none other than Lincoln himself. And just imagine these scenes as he's walking through. All of a sudden, he is mobbed by a sea of blacks who are now freed. And they are just jubilant and excited. They're touching him. They're trying to stroke him with their hands. They're grabbing at his pant legs. And at one point, he reaches out his hand and he says, "You are free. You are free as air." In that same visit, he will also do something really remarkable. Lincoln will make an unannounced visit on, of all places, General Pickett's house, Pickett of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. And Pickett's stunned wife opens the door, and she's cradling a newborn baby. And there is the Union president of all people. And Lincoln says, Lincoln takes the baby and cradles it, and he says, "I want you to know that I am going to pardon your husband for the sake of this child's beautiful face and its bright eyes." And Lincoln is, in his simple way in which he's telling timeless truths, he is saying, we must become countrymen again. And as he also says it later to the commanding general in Richmond, who says, "How should we deal with the defeated Confederates?" And, this is while there were the calls for hangings in the Union capital. Lincoln says quite simply, "I would let him up easy. I would let him up easy." It was really Lincoln's genius to sort of see that we had to heal somehow.
When Abraham Lincoln was assassinated at Ford's Theater,
yes,
I guess five days after the what we fairly identify as the close of the Civil War, where were Lee and Grant?
Lee was in Richmond. That day he would actually be photographed by the famed photographer Matthew Brady. And Grant was actually going up to New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Of course, we shouldn't forget that Grant was invited to Ford's Theater that night and turned it down. This, I was kind of shocked when I sort of saw the records of this. It turns out that Lincoln invited no less than 14 separate people to come with him that night, and they all turned him down.
Oh, my. Do we know what their reactions were, what was in their hearts?
What was in?
Grant and Lee's hearts when they heard the news about Lincoln's death.
Well, we know that Grant was crestfallen. Later, when this tearful scene that will go on for several weeks of Lincoln resting in state, and then eventually his train will wind its way back home where people will watch him in all the capitals. Grant weeps at his ceremony. It's very tender and very poignant, and it's probably the only time anyone ever actually openly saw him weep. And as for Lee, we do know what was in Lee's heart, because Lee gives an interview, of all places, not to a Southern newspaper, right, but to a Northern newspaper, the New York Herald, to Thomas Cook. And in this interview, he does three things. One of them is he celebrates the end of slavery. Another thing is he talks freely as a citizen of the United States, where just days before he had always spoken of himself as a citizen of the Confederacy, and this really shocked the interviewer. And Lee called on all other Southerners to do the same thing. And then he also very firmly condemns the assassination of Lincoln, saying it was the most execrable of all measures of all time.
Mr. Winnick, I'd like to end with having you paint once again for us, as you do in this book, a vignette that I've grown to think of as the real end of the Civil War. And that's of a Sunday morning when Robert E. Lee goes to church.
What happens is the war is over at this point, but just over. And it's in St. Paul's Church, which is where all the elite of Richmond worshipped. The ceremony was always the same, but all of a sudden interrupting the ceremony was a very different event. A black man, quite unexpectedly, just walked up to the railing to take communion. And everyone tensed, even the pastor of the church. And this was sort of Richmond Redux, what would happen next. And then all of a sudden, a man walked up. He was white-haired, he was graying, he was heavy around the center. And he had recently said, "I am penniless and homeless and have nothing left to live for." And this man walked up and he decided to take communion right next to the black man. And in doing that, he was saying to everyone else, "This is what the South should be for." And that man was Robert E. Lee.
Civil War ended on that day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
Mr. Winnick, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jay Winnick, author of April 1865, The Month That Saved America.